This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
So part of Buddhism is kind of being with it, but not reacting and causing yourself suffering. So the way that we see things, there's a story we tell of ourselves about what's going on in front of us, even though we're not necessarily even part of it, we're just watching from the sidelines, can cause us suffering. And I think the race conversation, when the race conversation happens, or people try to make it happen, it's just people suffering, white people suffering, black people suffering, and people trying to not to engage.
So welcome to Time to Talk with Alex Holmes. My name is Alex Holmes and I host this podcast weekly where I speak to guests for insights into all things health and wellness. We chat to mental health practitioners, therapists, psychologists, holistic practitioners, healers, authors, leaders from all walks of life, experts in their fields about all things mental health and wellness. Every conversation on Time to Talk is a calling card to an issue that is not readily talked about, but also with a guest who has something insightful to share, all with a view to make us the best people possible. So buckle up, let's get into the show. There are two ways that you can help support the podcast grow to be the best possible show that it could be. First one is free. Head over to Apple Podcasts, rate, review, and subscribe. Throw down a 5-star rating, a long, in-depth review, or as short as you want it to be, and share with your friends and family and get them involved in the conversations. Interact with me on Instagram over at @byalexholmes on there. Drop me an email at alex@alexholmes.co. Happy to have conversations with you guys. I really appreciate you all for listening. But the second one is more to help you guys see the show grow in the way that it could possibly do. And it takes a lot of effort to create these shows. So I've got a steady platform, which is very similar to Patreon, but it's over at steadyhq.com/Alex Holmes. And you can join me on there with one of the plans from as little as £6 per month. You can get access to private episodes, access to live shows, access to the video content that will be coming out with regards to the podcast very shortly and soon. So there's going to be so much exclusive content available for you guys there. So if you head over to steadyhq.com/Alex Holmes, you can subscribe and be a part of a growing community of people who want to see this podcast grow and really have those impactful mental health conversations that we hope can change the way that we all look at each other and help us be the best possible people that we can be. That's all. Let's get back to the show. This week on Time to Talk, I am so proud to bring you this conversation that I had. And we are a year later from the George Floyd murder and all of the killings and pain from last year hasn't necessarily gone away, but you know, it's a very interesting time to sit down and really take stock of the kind of year that we've had with the pandemic, with the Derek Chauvin verdict, with what's going on at the minute. So it's something to really take stock of. This conversation I have is with Eugene Ellis. And now Eugene Ellis is an activist, writer, and public speaker on issues of race, difference, and intersectionality. But more interestingly, he is a psychotherapist and a practicing Buddhist. He has a special interest in body-oriented therapies, mindfulness, and he's the founder and director of the Black African and Asian Therapy Network, as some may know it as BAATN, B-A-A-T-N, which is a network of therapists committed to and passionate about the psychological needs of Black African and South Asian people in the UK. I loved this opportunity to speak to Eugene because without BAATN, I would never have found my therapist. And it would never have set me on a path to be encouraged to enter into that world. So this conversation was amazing. But we talk about his experience growing up, you know, being a DJ, producer. You guys will love that conversation we have. But he also talks about the intersections of race and how it affects the body. And since the killing of George Floyd and all the trauma that's been going around, I've had a lot of conversations around body traumas in Black people, specifically in Black men. And it is a very welcomed conversation. So again, as I always say, thank you to my guest for joining me today on this episode. And also, to you guys, stay bold, stay brave and encouraged, and I thank you for kind of stepping into these bold conversations. So yeah, let me know what you think. Do rate, review and subscribe, share the episode far and wide, and let's get into the episode. Welcome to the show, Eugene Ellis. I'm so happy to have you here. And people are going to figure out why I'm so happy to have you here in a moment. But do you want to explain to the audience who you are?
Yeah. My name is Eugene Ellis. I'm a psychotherapist, mainly. That's kind of how I see myself. But I'm moving into new roles. I'm an author as well. And it's been a while saying this, but I'm also a practicing Buddhist, and I've been in Buddhism for a very long time, but it's been a slow journey of kind of naming myself that. And I think it's been a long journey of naming myself a psychotherapist as well. When I first trained, people wanted to know, you know, you're in a party or in a, you know, you're talking to someone, talking to friends or whatever, and or other people, and they, and what do you do? And I say, I'm a psychotherapist. And then the conversation would just kind of die at that point. But before that, I was actually a sound engineer. And so sometimes I just used to say I'm a sound engineer or something like that. And the music will flow. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, what did he do? And who did he work with? And the conversation would flow. But I think there's something about how I carry that label as well, psychotherapist, you know, Black male psychotherapist. There's not many of us, and I think I carry it differently. So I think it's going to be different. I think people experience me when I talk about it differently.
Yeah.
I think I was, what's my community going to say, think of me doing this work? And do they understand what I even do? Yeah. You're just talking, aren't you? You know, all that kind of stuff. So yeah. Those are my roles. And also, I'm also the founder of the Black African and Asian Therapy Network, which has been running for about 19 years. The primary aim really is to support people from those communities with their mental health, either by giving them access to therapists who they feel they could work with, or talking to training organizations, thinking of theory and those kind of things. So, and that takes up a big chunk of my time doing that work.
Yeah. And that's the reason why I was excited, because the Black Asian, or like African and South Asian therapy, sorry, the Black African and Asian Therapy Network was was how I found my therapist. And it really put me on this journey of talking about mental health and getting my own personal and self-development kind of on the way to doing what I'm doing. And I've been kind of shouting from the rooftops that people should just go. I've been calling it Barton for ages. I mean, to go to Barton and really, you know, tap into those therapists there, therapists that look like us and could have understand some of the cultural nuances that we explore and express. And sometimes I want to say personally, like publicly now, thank you so much for doing that.
Oh, that's really great. I'm so pleased. I'm really glad when people say that, you know, and people I don't know and people who I haven't met before, and I know that they've found something on the site. I mean, you don't have to see a therapist to go there. There's so much more stuff that you can engage with on the website. But yeah, thank you.
No worries. And it's amazing. But you've also got a book that we're going to talk about a bit later. It's called The Race Conversation: An Essential Guide to Creating Life-Changing Dialogue. So we're going to jump into that a bit later. But before that, I wanted to just ask you just a bit more about kind of your journey to get into that space. And I wanted to ask you, like, what was it like growing up for you? And how did you get to the point of training to be a psychotherapist and then eventually becoming a, you know, practicing Buddhist?
I mean, I say a little bit about this in the book, but when I was growing up, I felt fear for most of the time. I mean, I wouldn't have put it in those words, you know, at the time. It's only when I think back. And I mean, some of that fear, certainly when I was doing some therapy work, was really around my relationship with my father. And I guess any Caribbean person would know that, you know, beatings are just like the order of the day, aren't they?
Yeah. Which country are you from?
My parents are from Jamaica.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Likewise.
Yeah. And my parents have been living there for quite a while and sort of left us in the UK in the late 80s.
Yeah.
So mid 80s, early. But yeah, so, you know, that those kind of old time generational strategy, really, isn't it, to ensure that we sort of keep how can I put this? I mean, I think at the time when I was experiencing that, I mean, a lot of the beatings were for no reason I could think of, and again, a lot of us would identify that. I'm always in two minds about how much to say, because there are other people growing up in my family as well.
Yeah.
And how much not to say, but I've learned over the years that I just need to just say my experience, and I think it just feels better if I just talk about my experience, and then things just sort of click into gear down the road somewhere. And actually, if I'm the more honest I am about those things, the better it sort of feels like it turns out. Although it feels very scary to talk about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, my father really dished out the licks, really, really dished them out.
Yeah.
At one point, I can remember a particular scene where my mother was, I was in my room and I was sort of on my knees and she was sort of tending my back. So there was like, you know, beating marks on my back, and she was kind of tending them and sort of saying, I don't know what the exact words were, but kind of trying to get me to see his point of view, where he was coming from. And I still didn't get it because I was really small at that time.
Yeah.
And the fear of that really was just always present with me, always present. And I don't know whether it was just that or whether I was an introvert and I didn't connect with a lot of things that other people were doing that I saw. I liked the kinds of things that other people didn't like. I liked Star Trek. I liked to think about sort of lofty ideas and all that stuff. And that's not really where other people were. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of stayed pretty much in my little world, and I really kind of just disengage really from the coalface of life, you know. And then when I went to start work, I guess I was quite lucky. I was very hardworking. My dad was very, very hardworking, and I used to go and help him do his work. So I did get that from him, you know, hard work. Mm-hmm. And I started working in a recording studio. This was a recording studio owned by Pink Floyd,
okay,
the band.
Yeah.
And this was in Islington.
Yeah.
And I was what's called a tape operator.
Tape,
yes. In those days, it was like big 2-inch tape, 24 tracks. And that was the height of technology in those days, with those big, big desks and everything. Yeah. And I just hung around the studio. That's all I did. I just stayed in the studio. People came in, I looked after them, and I learned the job along the way. So I learned, you know, studio stuff and setting up microphones and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And eventually I was a sound engineer for the band Soul to Soul.
Yeah,
they came in to do their first album, and I was a tape operator in the studio. And it was that when they came in, it was just like, well, it was just like a breath of fresh air. I mean, it was just so like, yeah, this is it. This is the music that I want to do. And the stuff that I'd learned meant that I could actually do sound engineering. And Jazzy B asked me to be the sound engineer for the next few albums. So I moved into the studio in Camden, mm-hmm, where they set up, and I helped set up the studio. And it was an amazing time for me, actually, because
I was going to ask, what was that like?
Yeah, yeah, it was just, as well as meeting all these famous people and just listening to music all day. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing to, there was these black men, or, you know, young men, and they were just doing their thing their way. And people were loving it. You know, it wasn't just black people were loving it. Everyone was loving it. You know, we went to China, we went to Germany, we went to France. Mm. There were all kinds of people who really loved that music. And it was really, it was a real lesson, actually, in that you could be yourself. You could really express what you want to express and still be successful. People still want what you've got.
Yeah.
And so that was really, it was a really, really important time for me, actually, all of that. Mm. I mean, I was also very workaholic-y, so I'd spend all the time in the studios, and eventually it all came to a bit of a head, really, mostly around my body. My body kind of gave up. It's a bit strange just sitting down all the time. Yeah. My body kind of gave up, and it's a very strange thing to me. I do get it now, but my back went.
Oh, wow. Okay. From sitting down for too long, your back just
sitting down.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think it was quite an intense environment, and there was lots of people, and even though there was a lot going on, I think my natural, who I was as a person, and what was going on around me, I think which just my muscles just started to, you know, really start to contract. And I understand it more now as trauma, you know, just sitting in my body. And if I'm not really attending to my body, if I'm not really looking after it, stretching it out, doing what it needs to be done, you know, because the early trauma that I had, not necessarily just by my dad, but, you know, by the, you know, just living life as a black boy, you know, that gaze, you know, from your teachers, you know, you walk into a shop and that gaze again, they see it, you know, yeah, look on the telly,
it's
all
itself
there, and it all just, yeah, it just lodges yourself into.
So I had an experience about this the other day, and I was thinking to, because I went to get the vaccine, and I was in the waiting room with my mum, who is immunocompromised, so I accompanied her to get it. Mm-hmm. And I felt that, and I was in this space, and I looked up and I saw a lot of older white male doctors.
Okay.
And obviously they had their masks on, but there was a feeling around me that built, like, there's just this innate feeling of distrust, of nervousness, like, outside of the nerves of, you know, having to wear a mask and being in this pandemic and whatnot.
Sure.
But it was a nerve, it's like, this is like, it was an energy that I felt that I couldn't quite place, because I was like, it was an energy of suspicion. It was an energy of just the feeling of being around people who, for whatever assumptions I'm making, have been given opportunity to be that doctor or be that person and have that position of status and power around that. And it just felt, I could just feel it in my body. So understanding that, what you just said about, you know, things are just lodging in your body and in your space, it felt weird. It felt strange to me. And I thought about it, and I thought how a lot of people don't necessarily, you know, particularly white people, like, they don't feel that. I'm not sure they would feel that kind of fear or that kind of body alertness because when they're in a space, because they don't need to. And I don't know whether it's an epigenetic kind of thing to just sit there. Like, my body's gone through these states of knowing who to fear, knowing what to fear, or feeling what that kind of fear looks like, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I've certainly learned to know my body more. And the more I've got to know my body, the more I've kind of just noticed what, you know, just been aware of what's going on in there, and it's so busy, so active. And the way, you know, you've mentioned, you know, intergenerational stuff, epigenetics, I think that all plays a part. For me, when I think about trauma, when I think about those kind of experiences that we have in our bodies, it's all about intergenerational trauma. It's about things that have been passed on to us from past generations and our ancestors.
Okay.
Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to ask, because then we're looking at intergenerational stuff. And I'm going to ask you a question about post-slavery syndrome and intergenerational trauma in general, but if we just double back to your experience of beatings by your parents and things like that, what kind of effect did that have on the way that you kind of see or saw your parents, and as you grew up, what did that kind of delve into you? Because I look at that and I think, you know, there's distrust, or there's kind of like, you know, and there's kind of there's a disruption that happens between a parent and a child when they become physically abused, any kind of abuse. But there's a physical disruption, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at the time, he was the source of everything that was going wrong in my life and my life was. So he was the guy. And so I'd be angry at him, but that anger didn't come out directly towards him. It sort of just came back into me. And I also saw myself as weak. I saw myself as not being able to stand up for myself. Just being blown over by the wind. So it had a big impact on me, just how who I felt I was.
Yeah.
Because the message to me was, you're not strong enough, or you need to be stronger. And the reason, so it, somewhere in the background there was this kind of thing you're not strong enough. Or if you're going to go out into the world and do whatever you're going to do, then you need to be stronger than this. So I'm going to give you something that's going to make you strong. But for me, that didn't work. And it just kind of made me weak, made me feel weak. I think that was really what was a really lasting feeling. Yeah.
How did you move from that? How did you move through with that? Because that's it's a bit to carry, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it all came on top when I was working and as a sound engineer. I even though people were looking at me and thinking, wow, that guy's made it. He's got his car and
he's working with all these famous people, Chaka Khan, and all kinds of people are coming in. And yeah, and all these people was just coming, one person after another, these famous people coming into the studio, Gregory Isaacs, and it was just a crazy time.
Okay.
But in my heart, I just wasn't, I was just feeling flat in my body.
Mm.
I'm just feeling really, really flat. I know that now is depression. That's kind of what I would say it was. But at the time, it was just how I was. You know, I didn't experience myself any different than I did, you know, 5 years ago. So, you know, it was just me. It was just me, who I was.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that it wasn't right, though, at the same time, because I could see people around me. You know, I'd go into, yeah, I could see people around me just being different, and life was slightly different for them or easier. So I made a decision to go into therapy. I just looked in Time Out, saw somewhere close to me, just turned up, and it was this white woman. in Hampstead, you know, so it was like I'd gone right into the belly of the beast, though, you know? And so I was there for a little while,
yeah.
And then I was part of a group, and then I saw, and the group is mainly a lot of white people. There's another Asian person there and another black person there, but it was mainly white people in this group. And I was there for a while, and I could just see these people. It was like watching Coronation Street or EastEnders. Oh, you know, wow. The way that I didn't think people were like this. They were crying in real life. You know what, yeah. I mean? They were really talking about who they were, what they were up to. People were genuinely interested in listening, and it just felt like, wow, this is okay. I really had to just recalibrate who I was at that point. And actually it felt worse because mm-hmm. I couldn't do a lot of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I did want to. And I also wanted a relationship. I wanted to raise children. You know, I wanted to feel confident that I could do that with emotional positivity and, you know, being a father myself. I wanted to be able to be a father, like, you know, in a different way. Which kind of really motivated me to continue this therapy journey. And I did it in secret. No one knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
At the time, it would have been great if I could have just said, but that's not how it was in those days.
That is so interesting because there's this shame, isn't it? It's this idea of, I've decided to go to therapy, and it's like, especially in the black community, it's a bit like, well, why are you going to therapy? What business are you sharing with?
Yes, that's right.
You know, all that stuff. Yeah. And I remember I started therapy in 2017, and nobody knew. Like, literally, it was literally mm-hmm. me and my friend, and then a few friends slowly came to thing. And even recently, I spoke to my dad recently, and I just said, oh, I'm going to train to be a therapist. And he's like, okay. So you're going to be getting into the minds of people then, aren't you? And I'm like, okay. But then I was like, okay. Then he's like, oh, but who's going to be your therapist? And I'm like, I've been in therapy since 2017, and I'm sure we've spoken about this like several times. And he was like, oh, sort of stuff.
Mm.
And I'm just like, and I had to really address that and just think to myself, what was the reason for not mentioning that I was going through that process? And a lot of it was to do with shame.
That it must be mad or weak to need someone else
to
help you.
Yeah.
And I think that goes to the heart of things for me, that you need to do things for yourself. You need to be self-sufficient. And again, that's just another version of slavery, you know, internalized stuff that's been, you know, transmitted through the generations. You need to be strong. You need to be self-sufficient, do it on your own, manage your emotions. And if you don't, then there must be, there's something wrong with you. And you know, and I think that act of accepting help. And I think at that time, there was some sort of desperateness in me, and there weren't any other black therapists that I knew at the time. And I just had to go where it was available.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I later found a black therapist, a black male therapist. I'd had a few white therapists, and then it was just like another level having a black therapist, a black male therapist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you know about therapy, you know that there's kind of lots of things that go on, unconsciously between people.
Yeah.
And the things that were activated with my black therapist but just weren't activated with my white therapist.
Yeah.
It just wasn't the same.
Yeah.
I could go deeper, and it was actually more emotional, but it was actually more healing.
Yeah.
As well. And that was quite amazing, that experience, really, because it just it allowed me to work with my dad in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
And see black men in a different way.
In a different light, yeah, absolutely.
In a different light, you know. He was asking me questions about things that I thought weren't really allowed to go, you know, about crying, you know, about being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And I could just, you know, just my body just kind of loosened up over time. Yeah, so.
I want to ask you two things. First thing would be about emotional positivity and what that means, what that looks like. Mm. And the second thing would be about what was the feeling in the body that you felt the release or the change in you when you, you know, began to navigate through these breakthroughs.
I mean, at the beginning, I didn't really think about my body that much. It was a lightness in my general attitude to myself, and I didn't feel quite so depressed. And I think in the beginning, it was making connections and communicating with people on a deeper level, you know, saying that I was, you know, using the words, I'm not doing that well today, or I'm vulnerable today, or something along those lines to another human being, you know, for them to hear that. So that was transformational in itself, just that act. But if I think back about my body at that time, I think, you know, the way that you hold yourself, the way that you look at someone, you know, is your head up, you know, is your body straight?
Mm-hmm.
Are you looking on the floor? You know, where's your shoulders? You know, your shoulders back, and just those kinds of, they seem quite small things.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was going through my process, and I don't know if you felt the same,
mm-hmm.
my body changed, and it sort of like just stood up a bit more straighter walking down the road. I didn't feel quite so, I mean, if people were anxious about being with, you know, me coming towards them, I was less concerned about their anxiety, and I just carried on walking. Yeah. If they wanted to, you know, give me a wide berth, that was fine.
A bit more of a confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just a few millimeters, maybe a couple of centimeters, just difference in your body, the way you stand,
yeah,
makes a big, big difference. And I think it makes, and you meet the world differently, and then the world changes and reacts to you. And then it's like it's more of a positive cycle.
Yeah.
Whereas before, I think my energy was quite low.
Yeah.
And I didn't make contact, and people then didn't make contact with me.
Yeah.
And then around it goes.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's amazing how much of that is important to the day to day. Just the kind of the energies that we put out, simply like, and the things that we are receiving, and the way that we receive them, and how things are coming back to us, and just a small shift in perspective, a small shift in the way we show up on a day to day can really pull together. I mean, I'm forever writing on Instagram about showing up for ourselves. I'm sure people are annoyed that I keep saying this because it's just so revealing. But I'm like, but the way that we show up for ourselves is just so important. I mean, I start each day with an exercise of some kind or some kind of physical activity. And there's days I don't want to be there. I don't want to be doing this on the floor. Mm. I'd rather be asleep. No. But then once it's done, I'm like, I'm actually so proud of myself for showing up for myself to do, because that just might not happen. And then that then dictates how I navigate the rest of the day, because I'm like, all right, so I've showed up for myself before. I can show up for myself again in this conversation, again in this email, again in this, you know? So it tends to happen in that way. But I did want to ask you about the emotional positivity side of things. Is that similar to the whole energy putting out things? Because you were talking about you wanted to have, you know, a loving relationship, a family, and a life that you could kind of like really nurture and grow into. But how does emotional positivity sit in that now? And did you achieve all those things?
I did. Yeah. You know, I'm married. I've got a child. He's 20 now.
20? Okay.
Yeah. And he's working. And I think emotional positivity is a bit of a, it sort of sounds kind of nice, doesn't it? It sort of sounds kind of sugar sweet and honey glistened and all that. And I think that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, emotional positivity, not necessarily always being positive all the time, but it's about being able to take someone else's anger about you, or the things they don't like about you, the things that annoy them, and, you know, taking it for what it is, especially if it's someone who loves you, and then being able to do the same back and then recover from it. And I think that's, for me, is really, really important. So I think we can get into arguments and fights and even be very, very, you know, even be very damaging to each other on lots of levels. But often that's where it stops. Mm. It just gets stuck right there. And you know, certainly with my relationship, we've got, I mean, in all relationships, you just get into these stuck places that seem like it's just impossible to move out. You know, you're both angry, you both got your position, and that's it.
Yeah.
And emotional positivity, really, for me, is about how to sort of break that up. Because underneath all of that, there is love and there's connection, and there's a need to feel connected and be connected. And so it's messy.
Mm-hmm.
Emotional positivity is quite messy in some ways. That doesn't sound that. The words don't sound like that.
And I think this is the truth of it, though, isn't it? It's the truth of it, because I think that even I was writing some stuff about love the other day, and it's so important. And I was like, this kind of idea of love that we get given, this you know, this lofty, like, you know, floating on a cloud kind of, that is the space that we want to be in, and just like, you know, speaking softly like this, and it's all just, like, for me, I'm like, look, at the end of the day, right, like, that is a part of it. And this is what most of my investigations are into, because I'm very much like, right, we're going to take one bit and go right in and really figure it out. But even looking at that, you know, that kind of love is great, and that part of love is amazing, but like the messy parts of love kind of need to be looked at, because they're the things that get overlooked and get brushed under the carpet. And I don't know whether you can speak to the messy parts of love, but I'm literally just standing and observing and looking at it and just thinking, oh, how can I, like, how can we challenge that now? But I don't know what you can say to the messy parts of love.
I mean, they're going to be there.
Yeah.
And, you know, that beginning part, that beginning phase of love where everyone's on their best behavior and everyone wants to put, you know, both parties want to make a good impression.
Yeah.
And there's only a limit to that. There's a limit to that. And it's great. It is great. And people seek that particular feeling because it does feel great. There's lots of endorphins running through your body. Feel good. There's lots of good chemicals all sort of swimming around in there, And then when it gets messy, when it gets hard, they then go and find that same feeling somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's another level of something that people miss out then. And in a way, part of the difficulty is that our bodies, if we've been traumatized, or even the way we think about trauma as well is even needs a real look at, a real calibrate, really be calibrated around, because trauma normally we think of as someone's in a car accident or they've been mugged or something, and then that's what we think trauma is.
Yeah.
But trauma is all kinds of stuff. It could be just lots of little things, little drip, drip, drip things. Your boss just making racist comments, you know, literally every day.
Mm.
It could, or not necessarily to you, but in the, or putting a poster up on the wall, or putting signs up that don't include you.
Yeah.
All those little things, drip, drip things over the years can be quite, traumatic. And it sort of lives in our bodies. And then when things get difficult in relationships, it just, our body just can't take it. You know, it's just one step too far beyond normal living, normal living, especially for black people. And so, you know, I think attending to the body really, which I think therapy is, strangely enough, it sort of feels like, oh, you're just there talking, but actually you're attending to the body and you're making it a more resilient, more flexible, so that it can duck and dive and it can actually stay in the mess, but still respond with love and compassion for yourself, firstly, that's the first place. And then, you know, if you can extend it to another person, but even if you just have compassion for yourself, that can be enough just to break something up. And those difficult moments in relationships can kind of be, you know, they're in the rearview mirror after a while. Of course, there's going to be another one mm-hmm. down the road, but that they know that's just how relationships are. So I think for me, just I didn't really think about the body, but then I started to think more and more about the body over time, and I actually then started to think about but more in terms of sport and exercise and those kind of things, and keeping my body healthy in that way. But then I wanted to dig a bit deeper as well, and I took up meditation.
Yeah, I was literally going to ask you about that. How did that kind of all lead to you into the Buddhist mindset and then mindfulness and all of that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that is turning up for yourself, just sitting down and meditating or doing something.
I struggle with meditation. My mind likes to do gymnastics and hip hop dance routines. So I think that for me to actually sit down and do meditation, they're like, the studio's closed. What's happening? But explain to me how you got interested and involved in meditation.
My partner, my wife is a Buddhist.
Okay.
So, or she was a Buddhist when I met, and I wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason that I was involved in, not the only reason, but a big draw was that we were doing, in those days, they were doing people of color retreats.
Okay.
So she invited me onto this people of color retreat, and I mean, it was, you know, I fancied her anyway, so it wasn't a difficult decision to make. So I just got into this. How many people were there? 15, 20 people in the shrine room, all of color, just sitting there. So that was big anyway. Because I've always thought of meditation as white, you know, what white people do. Or what Chinese people do, or Indian people do, not what black people do. So again, so that was one thing, one tick. And so that was the way in, really. And I attended, these retreats. They were quite long. Sometimes they were a week long.
Okay.
Sometimes they were a weekend.
So interesting.
People would talk about the Buddhist way of thinking about things, and everything that was said, every single word that was said, I could just place into my experience.
Mm-hmm.
as a black man, which is odd thing to say and to experience, but there it was. And then it also, I was taught meditation, how to do it then. But when I first started, yeah, I thought I was the king, you know, because you're supposed to just sit there and count to 10 and count your breath. And,
yeah.
And so I was doing that, and everyone around me just seemed to be so deep in concentration. But after a while, I kind of got it. It wasn't really about me feeling good. So that was a turning point. Meditation mm-hmm. is not necessarily about feeling okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you spoke about, you know, you talked about sometimes you don't want to turn up for yourself in the morning. You wake up, you just don't want to do it. But yeah. then when you do it, you're glad that you did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because you know, there's so many other things to do yeah. in life. And I'm a bit when I wake up in the morning, my brain is on revving up. I can't wait to get onto.
Yeah.
Emails and doing stuff, and meditating is just in the way. You know what I mean? When I wake up, just in the
it's
way.
Like, it's like sit there and be what? Still?
You are?
Like, I have things to do. Yeah, but I see the benefit definitely, and I have experienced the benefits of it. I just think that, but I also recognize how important it is for me to actually make it work for the way that I work. Does that make any sense?
Sure.
So I know that in the morning, that's not going to happen. I'm not going to be doing it in the morning, because morning is where I need to be the most active. And but where I don't need to be the most active is in the evening, when I need to be resting. Mm. So I need to be doing meditations at night. And and that's kind of where that level of kind of self awareness is being, understanding that and really saying, you know, I need to sit down and take some time out for myself before I go to sleep to kind of encourage better sleep and better and a clearer mind for me to be getting to bed. But what was it like then making that decision to become a Buddhist? I'm intrigued as to kind of like what that meant for kind of, you know, raising and growing a family and the like.
I took a long time to get to that place, because I've been involved in Buddhist meditation for about 25 years. And I always said to myself that, the meditation was good and the teachings are good. But I'm not a Buddhist. I'm Buddhist, but no, I'm not Buddhist.
Yeah.
You know, and that was how it was. And I found it kind of hard to place myself in the order that I was spending a lot of time in, because the POC spaces, the personal color space, and then there were some other spaces. Called sort of Buddha field spaces, which are sort of, again, they're all kind of slightly on the outside of the center.
Mm.
So that's kind of where I place myself. And, but I think the more, and then I did some study. So if you want to, you can join these groups and then you can do study. And the first few years of the study, again, it was kind of just interesting. My mind likes these really big grand ideas, and yeah. I can dine out on them and chew on them, and it's all really great. I think since the beginning of the year, since COVID, really, and since George Floyd, I think it's really, really been. Mm-hmm. I've seen the study that I've been doing in a different way. It's sort of just, I mean, like many people, I mean, you know, I didn't know what to do or where to place myself around George Floyd. And I was feeling a lot in my body.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to, I mean, I have a back issue. And so I was literally at an osteopath just before I came onto this call.
Oh, okay.
Because, you know, my back muscles are just really, you know, that's where all my stress goes into my back.
Yeah.
I could just really, really feel it. I was literally bristling. My whole body was bristling when I was meditating. It's kind of calmed itself down now. Mm.
but I thought my mind was fairly clear around racism, mm-hmm. but it just got all fragmented again. And I think I just needed something bigger to hold what was going on. And I actually found the study of Buddhism, or the ideas within Buddhism, it really held my experience. It really held my experience of what I was going through. And not just held it, but actually then threw in a few pinches of compassion in there as well for me. And I could sort of see things shifting the more I embraced these ideas, the more I kind of dug into them. And so in a way it wasn't really blind faith. It was like just a kind of, this is working, that's mm-hmm. working. And over the years, it's kind of built up to the point where I just think, I'm not sure how I would think about the world if I didn't really have these ideas and these practices. And I don't really know if I'd survive even. That's kind of how it feels. Or you know, the idea of going back to the person I was before is just horrifying. Mm. It's just horrifying. I just don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so it's kind of grown on me. So it hasn't been an instant. And I know some people,
yeah.
you know, people of color spaces sort of come into it and it's bang, you know, they're kind of instantly there. And it's taken me a very, very long time.
It took its time with you, yeah.
Yeah.
So on this conversation around race and stuff, and based on all of your experience as a therapist and as somebody who, you know, has been practicing meditation and Buddhist meditation and the like, you say that, you know, your study then helped you kind of look at the race conversation slightly differently after. But what has it made you see now, looking at all of that and kind of the way that you want to kind of see a future for the way that we have, the way that we talk about race, the way we talk about blackness and whiteness, the way that we understand trauma and becoming all aware of all of these things?
Mm. I mean, one of the central ideas in Buddhism is about suffering, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we all suffer. And actually life is suffering.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way I see the race conversation is kind of around suffering and clinging as well, is another thing, sort of clinging to things. And I suppose I've been looking at the Trump campaign and the elections. And at one point I was literally on this thing for a couple of hours a day, listening to people, news reports and all that. And as I was listening to all of that, and I was seeing sort of whiteness on display in America in the way that it has been, I just feel really, really sorry for them. You know what I mean? For those guys. There's part of me that just feels like they must be suffering.
For who in particular?
To be behaving like that. And
for who in particular?
For a lot of the white people who are saying whatever they're saying on the airwaves about Trump and how they like him and what feel like lies. So that is so I guess just the way I see all that. I mean, if I experience it directly in front of me, obviously that's another story. If someone's going to be coming to me like that, but it's on the telly. And I'm watching it, so I can stand back from it a little bit and not get too engaged. But so part of Buddhism is kind of being with it, but not reacting and causing yourself suffering. So the way that we see things, the way that there's a story we tell of ourselves about what's going on in front of us, even though we're not necessarily even part of it, we're just watching from the sidelines, can cause us suffering. And I think the race conversation, when the race conversation happens, or people try to make it happen, it's just people suffering, white people suffering, black people suffering, and people trying to not to engage with the suffering. But then you think, well, why are white people suffering? We know why black people are suffering. Mm. And there's something about identity and what a white identity means for a white person. And the, you know, and the idea of losing that identity, the idea of losing privilege, clinging onto it, feels like it's suffering. So just all those ideas can kind of come, you know, people can come to the race conversation in a slightly different way with some of this information, and especially how trauma works as well, what happens to our bodies when we when we're triggered, and those kind of ideas. So that's kind of what the my writing has been around, and how to make those conversations real but less suffering involved.
What do you hope to see in an ideal situation? Somebody picks up your book, we you know, have the conversation, like in the next, you know, in the next 5, 10 years, 20. What do you hope to be seeing? I'm a annoying optimist, but I'm always interested to hear what other people hope to see when it comes to this stuff.
I think when one person is traumatized, we can see that they might get better down the road if they have the right. If they have the right conditions to do that, so one individual. So I think it's fair to think that if a generation or a group, one particular group, are traumatized as a group, that over time things will change. So I'm an optimist in that sense, but I think we've got a long way to go, and maybe even centuries still to go before we're undoing racism. But I think in the meantime, certainly with this book at least, I wanted to convey that it's possible to move beyond the surface discomforts and the self-preoccupations of race, and that it's possible to get into a genuine communication around it and a healing. And I think a lot of people feel it's just not possible. Mm. It's too big, it's too hard. And, well, why even try? And when you do try, it's really, really hard. So there's no point. So I just wanted to convey that actually there is, I have seen many people, myself, go through this process where race has just squashed me, and then I've somehow come up. So I wanted to convey that. I think that's really what I wanted to kind of say, really. So I am quite hopeful. I might be in a little bubble because a lot of people I know think like me, and I have lots of conversations, and they're very rich around race. So maybe it's just me being hopeful. But, you know, I look online and I look around, and there's all these conversations happening. Maybe not in the places that they really need to be happening, but it's getting closer. It feels like it's getting closer to the people who really need to know it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be a challenge for us to keep our foot on the gas, given what's been happening over the last few months, and to sort of keep race on the agenda. I'm sure it will duck back down again under and maybe subsumed by whatever else comes up in its place. But I think there's been a shift, it feels like to me, in how people want to engage with race. Because a few years ago, I mean, before, maybe last year or the year before, it was really, really hard to have a race conversation in ordinary life. But now it just seems hard not to.
Yeah.
You know, everyone really wants to have a conversation now around it.
Yeah.
Even though they might feel a bit awkward.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And, I mean, coming back to my dad, I mean, I think that was also an important thing to just finish off with him, actually, because even though I'd started off in a particular way thinking about him and my view about him, he was the cause of everything. That shifted after therapy, and also after doing writing and thinking about intergenerational trauma. I mean, I remember, I still have these vivid memories of sitting in these workshops as the only black person in these workshops, thinking about trauma
these lectures, and sometimes these lectures will be like week-long lectures, and the building would be packed with people. There'd be literally hundreds and hundreds of people in this room talking about the impact of trauma and working with trauma with patients.
Yeah,
I was only black man in the room. And I was listening to it very, very differently than the rest of the audience. I was thinking about, oh, this fits in with my dad. You know, this fits in with my sister. This fits in with me. Mm. And I know probably everyone else wasn't thinking that. And in a way, me and my dad were just sort of, we were caught up in a particular moment and in a particular time. And we were sort of caught up and shaped by intergenerational trauma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And at some level, it wasn't about him and it wasn't about me. And that kind of just freed me up a lot, really. And then my relationship with my dad did change. And I didn't really see him in the same way. And I could see that there was love there. I could see that he was what he was trying to do.
And doing his best.
And doing his best, yeah.
Yeah.
So that was a big shift. Yeah. But I think just knowing about trauma and how it works was really, really helpful for me in shifting that.
So as a way of rounding up then, I want you to talk to me about this Ben Okri quote.
Oh, yes. Ben Okri, I love Ben Okri, and this particular book, A Way of Being Free, is a very slim book. I like slim books that don't have too many pages, but it's packed full of wisdom, really, around stories, around storytelling. The quote is, it's easy to forget how mysterious and mighty stories are. They do their work in silence, invisibly. Beware the stories you tell or read subtly at night beneath the waters of consciousness. They are altering our world. And that has just been sitting on my desk. It sort of feels, okay, well, that sort of seems really obvious in some ways, isn't it? But the way I started Barton was based on that quote. And the way that I think about kind of what I say and what I communicate to people and what I choose to have coming at me is around stories. And, you know, we're humans, we seek story, you know, we're sort of story seekers, aren't we? And we seek meaning.
Yeah.
The stories give us, you know, the stories our parents tell about us, we become, and the stories that society tells us we also become. So we do reference ourselves to the stories that we tell ourselves and other people tell us. And that quote really, they work invisibly underneath the surface, because they really do alter what you perceive about yourself and others. And certainly with Barton, what I really want, the story I wanted to be told there was that you don't have to be mad or be locked up to attend to your mental health. Mm-hmm. And a lot of money goes into people who really have really acute personality disorders or psychotic breaks. And that's where we think the help needs to go. But I just thought, actually, there's this huge group of people, ordinary folk, going about their business, going to work, just, you know, bringing up families, doing their stuff. Those are the people that could actually benefit from therapy.
Absolutely.
Rather than the other people who are really at, you know, really at the death's door when it comes to their mental health.
Yeah.
So I really wanted to press that button on that group of ordinary people who were on the edge of something, perhaps. So I thought that was important. Also, it was important to tell a story of a community of people engaged in this work that look like you and that think you had your experience. So I was just very conscious of stories. So yeah, that quote, really really spoke to me at the time and still does, still sort of guides me. Yeah.
Amazing.
Thank you so much for listening to the episode. This show is produced by Pure Creation Media. If you want exclusive and private content and a way to support the show, head over to steadyhq.com/Alex Holmes and join the supporters who help me keep this show afloat for as little as £6 per month. You can also support the podcast by rating, reviewing the podcast over at Apple Podcasts. As the show gets more reviews and more ratings, the more the show can grow. Have a happy week. Until next time, I'll catch you then.